Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Focus on Albany. My guest today is Zach Williams, and Zach writes for City and State. And Zach is here to talk about the demolition of highways and Robert Moses. So, Zach, that was a pretty interesting article. Tell us a little bit about Robert Moses and what he did for the state of New York.
Well, Robert Moses first came onto the political scene in New York in the 1920s, especially during his time working under Governor Al Smith, first as a staffer and later as Secretary of State. And during that time, he had a big role in reorganizing state government. And in the subsequent years, his positions in state government just kept growing, first through the park systems, both at the state and New York City levels, and later through other public works, especially when it comes to highways. Now, when we really assess his roles, we have to think about, you know, the era he was in and what came before and what came after him. At the time that he first came onto the scene with highways in the 1920s, 1930s, and then subsequent decades, he really, transformed a highway system here in New York City that was just, you know, a few small stretches of highway here and there. Later, he built the first parkways on Long Island, and then in the subsequent decades, he built something like 600 miles of highways throughout New York City, as well as numerous bridges, tunnels, during his tenure as the chairman of the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority. So he really took New York from, dare I say, the horse and buggy and trolley days to the modern car-dependent metropolis that we have today.
According to what was the City and State newsletter that I get every day, the quote was this: New York is slowly deconstructing the legacy of Robert Moses and his highways from New York City to Syracuse to Rochester. Planners are aiming to revitalize urban areas, confront racial inequality, and even alleviate traffic congestion using fuel lanes. So I had read the book, like you, The Power Broker, and what I find very interesting is no matter who the elected officials were, Robert Moses intimidated everybody so much that nobody was afraid to say no to him or confront him. And because of that, what did he actually do? I know he was instrumental in building the Long Island Expressway and in the city. What else is his legacy?
So Robert Moses was a true believer in the car and its role in future cities. So he built numerous parkways on Long Island, a huge amount of highways here in New York City, but he also had enormous influence on urban planners throughout the state and across the country. Now, during my own reporting, of course, I saw that, you know, he built highways like the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway in Brooklyn, which is now entering the end of its usefulness. It's deteriorating, it's rusting. The time has really come for the city and the state to decide whether they want to repair it as it is today or build something new. Now, a curious concept emerged when Robert Moses built a lot of these highways to deal with traffic congestion on Long Island and in New York City. Every time he built one, as soon as it opened, it just filled up with more cars and increased the traffic congestion that it was built to alleviate. This is actually known now as a concept called induced demand. Basically, if you build infrastructure, it just encourages more people to use it. We've seen this in action, not just here in New York City and New York State, but across the country and now across the world. There's, for instance, a highway that runs from Beijing to Hong Kong that has something like two dozen lanes. Now, when it comes holiday season, it's just jammed packed. I believe there was one traffic jam that stretched for more than 50 miles. The bottom line is that rather than alleviating traffic congestion, Robert Moses really just made it worse. And A lot, and it also had secondary effects too. A lot of these highways went through downtown urban areas and divided them from, you know, the communities that were there, forced out low-income people. And now, again, now that these highways are becoming 50, 60 years old, cities across the state have an opportunity to, you know, either remove them and possibly replace them with more community-friendly infrastructure. We've seen this already in Rochester, where the Inner Loop East was filled in and replaced with an urban boulevard. And we're also seeing this starting to gain traction in cities like Buffalo with the Kensington Expressway, the Skyway that Governor Cuomo recently announced would in fact be taken down, as well as in New York City, where the Sheridan Expressway is going to be decommissioned and won't be an interstate highway anymore.
You know, the amazing part of this whole scenario is Robert Moses never drove a car in his life. And he envisioned all these people in cars, and, you know, he never drove. But what do you think of all of the stuff that he did? You know, how much do you think it cost the taxpayers of the state of New York?
Well, Robert Moses really created an empire for himself within New York City, especially through his chairmanship of the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority. I first got to mention that the Triborough Authority is a public authority, which is kind of a quasi-government organization where he was appointed by governors and he needed them to reappoint him when his, I believe, 6-year terms would run out. But other than that, he pretty much got to rule his domain as he saw fit. And public authorities like Triborough are enormously powerful. They have the power, for instance, of eminent domain. They can seize private property and use them ostensibly for the public interest, but really for the interest of Triborough itself. Now, each, you know, we should mention, too, that the revenue, while induced demand would invite more and more cars onto roadways, it also led to higher and higher revenues for Triborough. Now, you know, when we talk about Robert Moses and his effect, we really have to acknowledge that he was kind of a public servant run amok. He was an elitist. He just drove cars. And he really, after years and years and ensconced in power, kind of lost a sense of what the effect was of all of his public works on real people. He could drive around and go through all the toll booths at full speed that he wanted. But the average New Yorker in his time just found that their costs were going higher and higher when they drove, but it wasn't becoming any more convenient.
So basically, why do you think all the politicians feared him?
Well, he was also a bigger-than-life figure. You know, he was a tall man. He had a very booming presence. He liked to be the center of everything, and he, more than anything, wanted to get his way. He would exercise his leverage in a number of ways. I've mentioned how Triborough and the other public authorities he had were kind of outside the normal chain of command, if you will, of elected officials. But he was also enormously popular, and that's kind of gets to the heart of the paradox of Robert Moses, a man who, as the power broker by Robert Caro outlines, really had a lot of contempt for low-income, working-class people. Tenure as head of the Parks Department here in New York City, as well as the State Council of Parks, made him very, very popular with common people. He built Jones Beach, opened it up to common people. He built parks throughout the city and across the state. And this, of course, earned him a lot of popularity with people. There really weren't that many public parks to speak of before Robert Moses. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, though, if the public did not go with Robert Moses' way, he had no problem, you know, asserting his power. Probably a big turning point in his tenure, especially here in New York City, was when he got into it with the organizer of Shakespeare in the Park. That organizer, you know, that this is a free festival for Shakespeare performances that first started, I believe, in the 1960s. And, you know, for a lot of complicated reasons I can't get into now, Robert Moses wanted to shut it down because basically that organizer had defied him, and he took it as kind of a personal insult. And luckily for Shakespeare in the Park, the organizer actually kind of appealed to public sentiment, and people got a sense of just what a bully Robert Moses was. Now, that might have worked to save Shakespeare in the Park for a time and cost Robert Moses a victory here and there, but because he was so popular for so long, a key strategy he would always have with New York City mayors or governors would be he would threaten to resign. And oftentimes, you know, it was Mayor LaGuardia or governors like Thomas Dewey, they just, while they wanted to make Robert Moses back down on one project or another, they really had to consider that here was a guy that knew everything about how government works, could get things done, and just had a, you know, a great eye for, you know, getting big popular projects like roads and bridges done in a way that could benefit these politicians' electoral chances. So when Robert Moses would threaten to resign, they really had to do some quick political calculations to determine whether it was really worth it to win one victory but lose Robert Moses' expertise.
Wow. So when did Robert Moses' vision for the state of New York start crumbling? When did the politicians and the people in the state realize that what he had done was really not terrific for New York?
Well, when we assess the legacy of Robert Moses, we really have to look at it from several different vantage points. I don't think anyone even today would disparage his reputation for what he did on the park side. People love parks. They love playgrounds. They love Jones Beach. But when it comes to cars and the car culture that his highways encouraged, we get a very different reevaluation of his legacy. I think it was really in the last two decades where car culture and highway culture have really come into question, especially in their roles in cities. You know, in a city like Syracuse, the I-81 viaduct, you know, divided a historically tight-knit African-American community in a way that only now we can, you know, heal. The same, likewise, with the Interloop East, which kind of made a moat around Rochester and really encouraged white flight to the suburbs. And, you know, we're still dealing with those effects today. And also in recent decades, there's been a growing sense that, you know, if you want to eliminate traffic-related deaths, then you really got to control cars more. You got to limit their dominance of the streets. And in New York, we've seen, you know, we've seen traffic safety get more of a boost. But more importantly, you know, there was a big turning point in San Francisco, of all places, when an earthquake in the late 80s damaged an elevated highway on the Embarcadero. And because it was so, it knocked it out of commission, city planners in San Francisco actually decided to tear it down and open up the waterfront of San Francisco. Now, I don't know if you've been to San Francisco anytime soon, but it's hard to imagine an elevated highway along the beautiful, beautiful waterfront there. And in New York City, we've seen more investment in the waterfront and the economic benefits thereof. And now, increasingly, we're also seeing cities like Albany eye, you know, the Hudson River and the interstate that is separating access to it, you know, between the city of Albany and the waterfront itself. So, you know, it's really a time where easy solutions, just build more highways, move people around, is being seen less in isolation in cities that really want to take a more holistic approach to urban development.
Right. Because I know Assemblywoman Pat Fahey is interested in this particular issue. So, you know, Robert Moses was free to, you know, build his vision. So today, that vision is slowly being eroded. What are people, like you mentioned New York, what are people doing to undo what Robert Moses has done?
Well, I think the BQE is a really great example. You know, about a year ago, the de Blasio administration, you know, revealed that the, you know, unveiled plans to rebuild the BQE, much as it is today. Now, the BQE is a highway that straddles the northwestern section of Brooklyn. And in Brooklyn Heights, it actually changes into a triple-level structure where you have with the Brooklyn Promenade on top. Now, the de Blasio administration's plan was to maintain the roadway during construction. The way they were going to do that is to transfer the traffic onto what's the Promenade, a very, very popular tourist attraction to the neighborhood. The local neighborhoods, you know, they were, quickly pushed back at the idea, which kind of sent the de Blasio administration back to the drawing board. The mayor actually ended up appointing a council of experts who would determine the future of the BQE. Now, we're still waiting on what their study will recommend, but it seems like what is going to come out isn't going to be a simple, rehabilitation of the current structure. Instead, there'll probably be something that will maintain some traffic through that area, but will cut down some of the traffic lanes and seek to open up, the waterfront access between the Brooklyn waterfront and Brooklyn Heights to really foster a more community-friendly infrastructure in that area. So that's one. Another good example is the Sheridan Expressway in the Bronx. Now, this is a roadway that actually Robert Moses never saw completed to fruition. It was supposed to go all the way up about 13 more miles, but now it's really just a short and kind of redundant connection between the Bruckner Expressway and the Cross Bronx Expressway. The surrounding neighborhood has not done well, not just from the divisions that a expressway creates in the street grid, but also because of the associated asthma rates, the pollution, the noise, all these different things that have kind of dragged down the surrounding area. But in recent years, Governor Cuomo got behind the idea of actually decommissioning the Sheridan Expressway, taking away its interstate designation, and turning it into an urban boulevard that's not so different than many big streets that we see elsewhere in New York City. So that's supposed to get done, I believe, in the coming months. And, you know, what we see come out of the BQE project, the Sheridan Expressway project, will really serve as models for other highways, whether in New York City or throughout the state.
So this is going to cost quite a bit of money. Do you think that it would be worth all that money to tear down that cost a lot of money to begin with?
Well,
right?
That's a really interesting point. Highways certainly cost a lot of money, but that's why we're at such an inflection point with all these projects. When, you know, if we were talking about tearing down highways 30 years ago when they were still in good repair, there wouldn't be any political momentum for that, especially given the cost. You know, these projects cost hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe $1 billion in some cases. But now they're getting old. You know, they were designed to last 50 or 60 years, and Robert Moses was a mid-20th century figure. You know, the BQE, the Kensington Expressway out in Buffalo, especially the I-81 viaduct, they're nearing the end of their usefulness. And yes, we could replace them, but actually that would be more expensive than simply tearing them down and transforming them into, you know, urban boulevards. And I think that gets also to one other important point, is that when we're talking about tearing down highways, we're not so much talking about tearing down highways that connect cities to other cities. We're talking about removing highways from our urban cores in cities like Rochester, Buffalo, New York City, and diverting the traffic that goes from city to city to outside these urban areas, and really restoring the urban areas to, you know, places that encourage, dare I say, you know, the lifestyle that millennials like me want to have, you know, in the urban cores where there's, you know, lots of bars and accessibility, bike lanes, urban development, you know, where you can walk around or ride your bikes. That's kind of, you know, what seems to be the wave of the future, not just replacing and repairing highways, especially given the enormous cost that would have. So like in the I-81 viaduct in Syracuse, if they were to just rebuild it as it is today, not only would we be prolonging the damage that Robert Moses did to those neighborhoods, it would also cost a lot more money than this current community grid plan that that community activists are pushing out there.
So as you were talking, I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry. So you mentioned parks, and I think it's interesting because Robert Moses more or less built parks for white people, not for people of color. Do you remember reading that in The Power Broker?
Well, The Power Broker does detail a lot of the more unseemly and racist elements of Robert Moses' legacy. While he certainly built parks and pools and roadways in all the neighborhoods of New York City, his best works were always left for more affluent, whiter residents. For example, there were many, there was only one public pool built in Harlem, which is a historically African-American neighborhood, whereas there were many such pools built in much more richer, much more whiter neighborhoods. I don't think that's any secret about Robert Moses's legacy. Some of his defenders have pushed back at what Robert Caro wrote in The Power Broker, but all in all, if you just look at a map of where all the parks and pools of New York City are, it's pretty obvious that he tended to build them in white neighborhoods rather than black neighborhoods. And I think a lot of the other projects he did reflect similar thinking. You know, he was definitely a man who not only believed that richer people were more noble people, it was an idea that was much in line with his upbringing in the early 20th century. And I think his public his public works legacy reflects that.
You know, one of the chapters that was left out of The Power Broker was the chapter on Jane Jacobs. The politicians feared him, but Jane Jacobs, you know, had the guts enough to stand up to him, and ultimately that was the beginning of his demise. So do you know anything about Jane Jacobs and the role she had in New York City?
It's interesting you bring up Jane Jacobs, because one of the knocks that I've heard against Robert Caro, the author of The Power Broker, is how he's kind of demoted the role of women in a lot of his works, whether it was Robert Moses or his series on Lyndon Johnson. Jane Jacobs, of course, is the community activist and author of The Life and Death of American Cities, who pushed back, who was the leader of the pushback against this idea to build a expressway through Lower Manhattan. This was a project that Robert Moses and political leaders really wanted to see done. But she pointed out that, you know, if they did that, they would destroy Greenwich Village. You could not imagine New York City right now without, you know, Washington Square Park and all the quaint architecture of that area, especially in a city that often forgets its past. So I think it's fair to say that Jane Jacobs not only helped start the historical preservationist movement, but really started this movement where urban planners started thinking that, you know, city streets aren't for cars, they're for people, and that they foster a community and a way of life that not only can move goods around, can get people from point A to point B, but are worthy in themselves. You know, they create communities. They are places where people talk, where people live their lives. And in that, they're just as valuable as any other part of the cityscape.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the closing minutes, do you have any final words on, you know, the tearing down of highways or, you know, anything about Robert Moses or anything else you'd like to add?
Well, certainly there are thousands of miles of highways across New York State. When we're talking about deconstructing Robert Moses, if you will, we're talking about taking down the worst parts of his legacy, the highways that were rammed through the inner cities of our state, the highways that divided communities, the highways that displaced thousands and thousands of people from their homes. All of this to serve not just the automobile, but the whims of a man who, while very gifted in the ways of state government, was never trained as an urban designer, was not a civic engineer. He was a man who, you know, of great vision, who learned the mechanics of government, but at the same time, he was never willing to hear other opinions. Whether you were a member of the public or someone that worked for him, you had to support his ideas if you ever wanted to get things done. And I think that gets to the heart of Robert Moses' legacy, which is, you know, we live in a democratic society, but it's often hard to get things done when you need to have the perspectives of millions of people incorporated into something. You don't really get very far with it. So while it's important to have someone in charge with vision, somebody that knows how to get things done, as Robert Moses always took pride in doing, you also need to balance that with the, you know, the strictures of a democracy that demand that you can't just always have your way. You need to look at the big picture. You really need to get as many viewpoints as possible, even if you can't make everybody happy in the process. And I think that's something that Robert Moses failed to do, all in all, especially when it came to highways. And while New York City would never be the same and will always have his bridges, his parks, we're finding increasingly that maybe we can live without his highways.
Wow. Okay. So, Zach, you write for City and State. Give yourself a little plug.
Well, I cover the legislature for City and State. We're a magazine that, as the name implies, covers city and state politics. And anybody that wants to see our work should certainly subscribe to our First Read newsletter or read our stuff at cityandstateny.com.
Thank you, Zach. I look forward to talking with you again. You've been listening to Focus on Albany. I'm Cynthia Pooler. If you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes. If you have a comment about this show, hashtag Focus on Albany on Twitter. Thanks, Zach. Have a great weekend, and thank you, everybody, for listening.